Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is side one of For the Record program number 651. The engineer has wrecked the train. This program is being recorded on November 2nd of the year 2008. www.spitfirelist.com. I mention the spitfirelist.com website because although it's an old, or for those listeners who've used it in the past, it's an old URL, but it is an entirely new website. New site, same fight. I can't stress strongly enough that listeners use that website, the books, the long printed article length descriptions of programs, the tremendous links to tremendous number of links to audio files, to print files inside and outside of the website, a huge research online research resource, and something that I've been working very, very hard on and that others have worked very hard on as well. So please use it. I'm still in the process of transferring files and still on that steep learning curve, but it's taking shape. It's bearing fruit, so please do use the website, and if you're in a position to do so, I know times are tough, you can visit the page with which you, that encourages you to support yours truly. Now, the title of this program, The Engineer Has Wrecked the Train, is a direct reference to For the Record program number 412, recorded in early June of 2003. Roughly 5.5 years ago, not quite 5.5 years ago, pretty close, I did a broadcast in which, among other things, I entertained the serious possibility that the fiscal policies being pursued by the Bush administration and the forces that they represent, the policy of spending tremendous amounts of money on military-related matters and other boondoggles, other pork, so to speak. Not that the military is in and of itself pork, although some individual product or projects, I think, could be considered that. The fact of the matter is, at the same time as the Bush administration waged war, they cut revenues, and I'll toss the gauntlet down to anyone to find me a leader in all of history, a world leader who has slashed revenues while waging war. Usually, you raise taxes to raise revenues so you can finance the war. And in For the Record 412, I entertained the thesis that it also was entertained by the Financial Times of London's editorial board, and also recently Pulitzer Prize-winning economist, or Nobel Prize-winning economist, Paul Krugman, who was examining, along with the Financial Times, the possibility, deemed a conspiracy theory, that these fiscal kamikaze policies were deliberately intended to produce a fiscal train wreck, which in turn was deemed necessary by the right-wing radicals in this administration to force the slashing of social programs that the American people would want to otherwise hang on to. And in that particular program, I cited some very, very scary numbers about the amount of federal revenue that was going to be needed to maintain, so to speak, and about the increasing demands that were going to be made. And those numbers were truly scary back in 2003. In the second side of this broadcast, we're going to revisit some of those numbers. But in light of what has taken place since, and in particular in light of the fact that the U.S. government, the U.S. taxpayer, i.e. you and I, are now going to be underwriting an awful lot of these failed institutions, just exactly how we're going to be paying for this, or how we're, what's going to happen if we can't pay for it, is a question that needs to be understood and entertained. And looming in the background, certainly greed was a major factor in helping to precipitate this mess. But I also think that it's worth asking the question about the possibility that other forces, sinister forces, deliberately intended to exacerbate the Bush administration's fiscal train wreck in order to bring about the destruction of the United States itself. Think in this regard the Bormann Capital Network, Underground Reich, and forces that have never liked the idea of the Enlightenment, democracy, and a lot of other things that the United States has traditionally represented. This seems far-fetched. Just bear in mind that the Republican vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin's husband, described as a shadow governor, has long been associated with the Alaska Independence Party. That is one of these secessionist parties that has allied itself with, among other institutions, via linking on the websites, the UNPO, and other entities pushing for the breakup of larger states in order to realize the supposed aspirations of small peoples within those larger states. So again, I think one needs to ask the question. Certainly, the train has been wrecked. How much of what has taken place was part of that deliberate intent? Now, we're going to be taking a look first at an article that talks about why the collapse of the insurance giant AIG, whose shenanigans we've examined in a couple of broadcasts with the brilliant Lucy Commissar. We're going to take a look at why the collapse of AIG precipitated the deep-sixing of so many banks back in the recent fall. The following article is titled, How AIG's Collapse Began a Global Run on the Banks. It's by Porter Stansbury. It's from an investor's newsletter at www.dailywealth.com, about something, a website about which I know very little. The article reads, If September didn't give you enough to worry about, consider what will happen to real estate prices as unemployment grows steadily over the next several months. As bad as things are now, they'll get much worse. They'll get worse for the obvious reason, because more people will default on their mortgages, but they'll also remain depressed for far longer than anyone expects, for a reason most people will never understand. What follows is one of the real secrets to September's stock market collapse. Once you understood what really happened last month, the events to come will be much clearer to you. Every great bull market has similar characteristics. The speculation must, at the beginning, start with a reasonably good idea. Using long-term mortgages to pay for homes is a good idea with a few important caveats. Some of these limitations are obvious to any intelligent observer, like the need for a substantial down payment, the verification of income, an independent appraisal, etc. But human nature dictates that, given enough time and the right incentives, any endeavor will be corrupted. This is one of the two critical elements of a bubble. What was once a good idea becomes a farce. You already know all the stories of how this happened in the housing market, where loans were eventually given without fixed rates, without income verification, without down payments, and without legitimate appraisals. As bad as these practices were, they would not have created a global financial panic without the second, more critical element. For things to really get out of control, the farce must evolve further into fraud. And this is where AIG comes into the story. Around the world, banks must comply with what are known as Basel II regulations. These regulations determine how much capital a bank must maintain in reserve. The rules are based on the quality of the bank's loan book. The riskier the loans a bank owns, the more capital it must keep in reserve. Bank managers naturally seek to employ as much leverage as they can, especially when interest rates are low, to maximize profits. AIG appeared to offer banks a way to get around the Basel rules via unregulated insurance contracts such as credit default swaps. Here's how it worked. Say you're a major European bank. You have a surplus of deposits because in Europe people actually still bother to save money. You're looking for something to maximize the spread between what you must pay for deposits and what you're able to earn lending. You want it to be safe and reliable, but also pay the highest possible annual interest. You know you could buy a portfolio of high-yielding subprime mortgages, but doing so will limit the amount of leverage you can employ, which will limit returns. So rather than rule out having any high-yielding securities in your portfolio, you simply call up the friendly AIG broker you met at a conference in London last year. What would it cost me to insure this subprime security, you inquire? The broker, who is selling a 5-year policy but who will be paid a bonus annually, says, "Not too much." After all, the historical loss rates on American mortgages is close to zilch. Using incredibly sophisticated computer models, he agrees to guarantee the subprime security you're buying against default for 5 years for, say, 2% of face value. Although AIG's credit default swaps were really insurance contracts, they weren't regulated. That meant that AIG didn't have to put any capital as collateral on its swaps as long as it maintained a AAA credit rating. There was no real capital cost to selling these swaps, and there was no limit. And thanks to what's called mark-to-market accounting, AIG could book the profit from a 5-year credit swap, a 5-year credit default swap as soon as the contract was sold based on the expected default rate. Whatever the computer said AIG was likely to make on the deal, the accountants would write down as actual profit. The broker who sold the swap would be paid a bonus at the end of the first year, long before the actual profit on the contract was made. With this structure in place, the European Bank was able to assure its regulators it was holding only AAA credits instead of a bunch of subprime toxic waste, unquote. The bank could leverage itself to the full extent allowable under Basel II. AIG could book hundreds of millions in profit each year without having to pony up billions in collateral. It was a fraud. AIG never had any capital to back up the insurance it sold, and the profits it booked never materialized. The default rate on mortgage securities underwritten in 2005, 2006, and 2007 turned out to be multiples higher than expected. And they continued to increase. In some cases, the securities the banks claimed were AAA have ended up being worth less than 15 cents on the dollar. Even so, it all worked for years. Banks leveraged deposits to the hilt, Wall Street packaged and sold dumb mortgages as securities. And AIG sold credit default swaps without bothering to collateralize the risk. An enormous amount of capital was created out of thin air and tossed into global real estate markets. On September 15th, all of the major credit rating agencies downgraded AIG, the world's largest insurance company. At issue were the soaring losses in its credit default swaps. The first big write-off came in the fourth quarter of 2007, when AIG reported an $11 billion charge. It was able to raise capital once to repair the damage, but the losses kept growing. The moment the downgrade came, AIG was forced to come up with tens of billions of additional collateral immediately. This was on top of the billions it owed to its trading partners, and it didn't have the money. The world's largest insurance company, AIG, was bankrupt. The dominoes fell over immediately. Lehman Brothers failed on the same day. Merrill Lynch was sold to Bank of America. The Fed stepped in and agreed to lend AIG $85 billion to facilitate an orderly sell-off of its assets in exchange for essentially all the company's equity. Most people never understood how AIG was the linchpin to the entire system. And there's one more secret yet to come out. AIG's largest trading partner wasn't a nameless European bank, it was Goldman Sachs. I've wondered for years how Goldman avoided the kind of huge mortgage-related write-downs that plagued all of the other investment banks, and now we know. Goldman hedged its exposure via credit default swaps with AIG. Sources inside Goldman say the company's exposure to AIG exceeded $20 billion, meaning the moment AIG was downgraded, Goldman had to begin marking down the value of its assets. And the moment AIG went bankrupt, Goldman lost $20 billion. Goldman immediately sought out Warren Buffett to raise $5 billion of additional capital, which also helped it raise another $5 billion via a public offering. The collapse of the credit default swap market also meant that the investment banks, all of them, had no way to borrow money because no one would insure their obligations. To fund their daily operations, they'd become totally reliant on the Federal Reserve, which has allowed them to formally become commercial banks. To date, banks, insurance firms, and investment banks have borrowed $348 billion from the Federal Reserve. Nearly all of this lending took place following AIG's failure. Things are so bad at the investment banks, the Fed had to change the rules to allow Merrill, Morgan Stanley, and Goldman the ability to use equities as collateral for these loans, an unprecedented step. The mainstream press hasn't reported this either. A provision of the $700 billion bailout bill permits the Fed to pay interest on the collateral it's holding, which is simply a way to funnel taxpayer dollars directly into the investment banks. Why do you need to know all these details? First, you must understand that without the government's actions, the collapse of AIG would have caused every major bank in the world to fail. Secondly, without the credit default swap market, there's no way banks can report the true state of their assets. They'd all be in default of Basel II. That's why the government will push through a measure that requires the suspension of mark-to-market accounting. Essentially, banks will be allowed to pretend that they have far higher quality loans than they actually do. AIG can't cover for them anymore. And third, and most importantly, without the huge fraud perpetrated by AIG, the mortgage bubble could never have grown as large as it did. Yes, other factors contributed, like the role of Fannie and Freddie in particular, but the key to enabling the huge global growth in credit during the last decade can be tied directly to AIG's sale of credit default swaps without collateral. That was the barn door, and it was left open for nearly a decade. There's no way to replace this massive credit-building machine, which makes me very skeptical of the government's bailout plan. Quite simply, we can't replace the credit that existed in the world before September 15th because it didn't deserve to be there in the first place. While the government can and certainly will paper over the gaping holes left by this enormous credit collapse, it can't actually replace the trust and credit that existed because it was a fraud. And that leads me to believe that the upcoming economic contraction will be longer and deeper than most people understand. And I would ask, how is all of this lending of taxpayer dollars, all of this lending of federal monies to bail all of these things out going to work? Now, a sudden influx of foreign investment capital could help things. It remains to be seen what the results of this coming Tuesday's elections will have on this entire situation. And again, I'm recording this on Sunday, November 2nd of 2008, this coming Tuesday. History will be written one way or another. And we'll see how that affects things, but it is daunting to say the least to evaluate the economic and consequently the political future. Lucy Commissar has an article that she has written about the need to for the federal government now to begin examining AIG in light of its offshore dealings. Now, in For the Record 531 and then later in For the Record 650, we took a look at AIG and some of its shenanigans, and listeners can use the SpitfireList.com website, both the audio file and the printed descriptions, to update themselves on that information. The article that Lucy has written is as follows. This is titled, U.S. Should Examine AIG's Use of Tax Havens. It's by, of course, Lucy Commissar. Now that it controls AIG, the U.S. should investigate the extent to which this giant corporation with subsidiaries in major tax havens has been using the offshore system to cook its books and dodge U.S. taxes. Evidence shows AIG has done so in the past. The U.S. takeover of the world's largest insurance conglomerate, AIG, puts it in a unique position to look into the inner dealings of a company that is a profligate user of tax havens. AIG has employed offshore shell companies to cook its books and dodge taxes. The new U.S. managers should investigate how they do it. AIG's favorite offshore jurisdictions are Bermuda, Barbados, Switzerland, and Luxembourg, places immune from even the lax enforcement of America's state insurance regulators and the Securities and Exchange Commission, or SEC. AIG's offshore subsidiaries include American International Assurance Company Limited, Bermuda, American International Reinsurance Company Limited, Bermuda, AIG Life Insurance Company Limited, Switzerland, and AIG Financial Advisor Services, S.A., Luxembourg. AIG in the past has used tax havens to evade regulations, and hide insider connections in supposedly arm's-length deals. This is especially significant as the company has moved into financial services and asset management. It has also used the offshore system to evade U.S. taxes. Here are two examples, the first reported exclusively by this writer. AIG helped Victor Posner, a notoriously crooked investor, set up an offshore reinsurance company so that Posner could evade U.S. taxes. The policy scam was discovered in the early 1990s after the SEC prosecuted Posner for a fraudulent takeover scheme concocted with Wall Street thieves Michael Milken and Ivan Boesky, and the SEC ordered him to pay $4 million to fraud victims and banned him from serving as officer or director of any publicly held company. New managers took over Posner's NVF Corporation, which ran a Delaware vulcanized rubber plant. An insurance agent charged with examining company policies discovered that NVF was paying AIG's National Union Fire of Pittsburgh substantially over market for workmen's compensation insurance. AIG reinsured the policy through Chesapeake Insurance, an offshore reinsurance company Posner owned in Bermuda. In essence, NVF, owned by Posner, was buying insurance from an AIG company, which was buying reinsurance for the policy from an offshore company owned by Posner. Bermuda provided tax and corporate secrecy, so Chesapeake's books were safe from the eyes of American regulators and tax authorities. AIG and Posner made out like bandits. Parenthetically, those of us who are backing these up with our tax dollars necessarily haven't. Continuing. AIG got a higher commission from the initiated NVF premium before sending the rest to Chesapeake. Posner wrote off the entire amount as a business expense and enjoyed the extra cash in Bermuda tax-free, stiffing the U.S. government. Reduced profits also meant smaller dividends and share prices for investors. The insurance agent canceled the NVF policy with AIG, but the Delaware Insurance Department did not make the scam public or take any action against AIG. A former insurance department regulator told me, quote, "This was not an isolated case with Vulcan NVF. AIG did that a lot. AIG helped companies set up offshore captive reinsurance companies. A captive is owned by the company it insures. AIG, he alleged, would then overcharge on insurance and pay reinsurance premiums to the captives, giving the captive owners tax-free offshore income. AIG says that it pioneered the formation of captives, unquote, and offers management facilities to run them in offshore Barbados, Bermuda, Cayman Islands, Gibraltar, Guernsey, the Isle of Man, and Luxembourg, all places where corporate and accounting records are secret and taxes minimal or non-existent. Another scam helped AIG dodge taxes and U.S. regulations. Insurance companies normally insure themselves by laying off part of their risk to reinsurance companies, so if a claim comes in above a certain amount, the reinsurance company will pay it. State laws also require them to keep a certain amount of capital available to pay out claims. If they have reinsurance, that amount can drop. Companies have to show losses, amounts they have paid out, on their books. If they have enough good reinsurance, they get a credit for that against their losses. The reinsurer, of course, has to be an independent company. The risk isn't reduced if it's moved to just another division of the same company. In the mid-1980s, two of AIG's reinsurers failed. AIG would have had to curtail writing new business since rules require a certain ratio of assets to risk. Finding new reinsurers was going to be difficult and expensive. CEO Maurice Hank Greenberg persuaded several of his business friends to set up a company into which he could seed AIG Insurance. The company was launched with a private sale of shares organized by Goldman Sachs, then headed by Robert Rubin. Greenberg's frontmen were loaned the money to buy risk-free shares in the new Coral Reinsurance, an alleged independent offshore reinsurance company, to allow it to legally move debt off AIG's books and violate rules about maintaining minimum levels of reserves required to pay off claims. The company was registered in Barbados, where capital requirements and regulation are minimal, where American regulators couldn't readily discover AIG's involvement, and where, as an added incentive, it could evade U.S. taxes. If Coral Re was an AIG affiliate, it would have to pay taxes on its income. A Delaware Insurance Department regulator's report in 1996 said that Coral Reinsurance, quote, may be an affiliate of AIG. It described how AIG played an integral role in the creation of Coral Re, that its purpose was to reinsure risks for AIG companies, that virtually all Coral Re's business had originated from AIG units, and that Coral Re was managed by an AIG subsidiary. It concluded that the arrangement did not transfer risk and had to come off the books. The insurance departments of New York and Pennsylvania agreed, but delays and stonewalling allowed AIG to use Coral Re for more than 8 years. By the time it had to shut down, it didn't need it anymore. Cowed by AIG, none of the agencies levied the penalty. It would be unthinkable for the U.S. to allow a business it controls to finesse regulations, evade taxes, or help others to evade them. The turnover of AIG to the U.S. will involve extensive examinations by accountants. An analysis of the company's offshore strategies should be part of the audit. What accountants learn could stop illicit practices by AIG and lead to laws to prevent other insurance companies from doing the same. So that, again, an article by Lucy Commissar on encouraging people to, or encouraging the populace, so to speak, to take a good look at AIG's offshore books. And indeed, one of the questions that looms very large as we attempt to perform triage on the financial mess, and that is just how much of this money is indeed beyond reach. There was an editorial, an op-ed column in the Wall Street Journal on September 30th of 2008, that by Robert Morgenthau, who was the former district attorney for Manhattan in New York and also an individual who did a lot of investigating and prosecuting of the BCCI case. It's called Too Much Money is Beyond Legal Reach, and it's about offshoring. A major factor in the current financial crisis is the lack of transparency in the activities of the principal players in the financial markets. This opaqueness is compounded by vast sums of money that lie outside the jurisdictions of U.S. regulators and other supervisory authorities. The $700 billion in Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson's current proposed rescue plan pales in comparison to the volume of dollars that now escape the watchful eye not only of U.S. regulators, but from the media and the general public as well. There is $1.9 trillion, almost all of it run out of the New York metropolitan area that sits in the Cayman Islands, a secrecy jurisdiction. Another $1.5 trillion is lodged in four other secrecy jurisdictions. Following the Great Depression, we bragged about a newly installed safety net that was supposed to save us from such a hard economic fall in the future. However, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Federal Reserve System, the controller of the currency, and others have ignored trillions of dollars that have migrated to offshore jurisdictions that are secretive in nature and outside the safety net, beyond the reach of U.S. regulators. We should have learned a long time ago that totally unsupervised markets, whether trading in tulips or in subprime mortgages, will sooner rather than later get into trouble. We don't have to look back very far into history to understand this. Long-term capital management, a hedge fund based, unquote, in Greenwich, Connecticut, but composed of eight partnerships chartered in the Cayman Islands, was supposed to be the wunderkind of the financial world. At its peak in the late 1990s, its gross holdings were valued at $1.8 trillion. But regrettably, its liabilities exceeded its assets, and the Federal Reserve Bank of New York had to step in and rescue it when the value of its assets plummeted. And we're going to continue with a reading of this article on side two of this program, and we're also going to reprise some of the discussion from For the Record 412. www.spitfirelist.com. The spitfirelist.com website is the same URL that listeners have been using for years now, but it is a very new, much more professional-looking, much more user-friendly website with a tremendous and growing amount of printed and audio information. Use that website, the linked FTR supplemental websites, the www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery website, and listeners will be able to get themselves up to speed on many of these issues. For example, Lucy Commissar's work on offshoring and AIG, covered in, among other programs, 650 and 531, and you can use the websites to get up to par. That concludes side one of For the Record program number 651, The Engineer Has Wrecked the Train. This program is being recorded on November 2nd of 2008. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.